this particular company, okay, decided to incorporate. Let's put it this way. They had a store opened up just before Christmas in Covent Garden. For those of you who have not been to London, that's like a seriously shishi place, okay? You don't end up in Covent Garden unless you got some moolah, some dinero. This company claims to be able to make predictions. Fine, okay? He can't, but say he can. But then with some Fitbit, Garmin-y type of watch thing, okay? And here's the thing. You're then able to take your genetic readout, link it to an app on your phone, fine, and then link to this 80 euro, you know, watch thing. So when you go to the supermarket, you can then use your phone and scan the barcode behind the chocolate bar, the beer, whatever it is. And then what then happens is the phone, your watch blinks red or green to tell you whether or not you should eat or buy said item. Completely BS, I want to point out. And anyway, when would it actually blink green when you're at the beer aisle? The bottom line is, I think it will intersect at some point to a degree. I just don't think we are there yet. We are nowhere near the level of prediction that we can get based on the genomic information we have. Why? Genetics is the easiest bit to actually determine. It's empirical. It's the same when you're born. It's the same when you die. Okay, and it's getting cheaper. The problem is measuring the environment.
Hi, and welcome back to the Gastronauts Podcast. My name is Peter, and I'll be your host. Here at Gastronauts, we are committed to exploring communication throughout the body with a particular focus on the crosstalk between gut and brain. We have a follow-up episode for you all today. This is based off a previous Zoom side chat that we held on the future of food, curated by Dr. Diego Borges, and we would like to share this discussion with you.
Great. We have Professor Giles Yeo joining us from Cambridge University. We have Darren Logan, a sensory neurobiologist from Mars Pet Care Waltham Nutrition Laboratory for Pets, and Laura Boykin, who is a TED Senior Fellow and a pioneer of portable genomics.
My name is Giles Yeo. I am from Cambridge University, and I'm a geneticist by trade. So I study genetics, and I'm interested in studying the genetics of feeding behavior, which is what I study. Actually, I study the genetics of body weight, which now we know by definition is the studying of feeding behavior. And I'm interested in why we behave differently around the environment we do in terms of food intake in the current food environment. So I teach and research here at the university. But in addition, I've also done some broadcasting, and I've written a book called Gene Eating, which is the title in which I'm being introduced here. And it's really about fad diets and how our genetics can actually inform us about how we respond to different types of food. Without overstating the fact, it's an embryonic field. Nutrigenomics, so the genomics of how we actually respond to food and what kind of different diets that we might actually choose. And I guess my shtick, we always have a shtick, is that body weight, obesity being one end of the spectrum of body weight, is not a choice. It isn't. I mean, you might think, well, hang on a second. Yes, it is. I'm choosing to put the pizza in my mouth. Of course it's a choice. Except that we now know that the biology that underlies us, the genetics underlying, make it more difficult for some people to say no than others. Okay, so in other words, it's all about food intake because it's physics. Okay, food intake, not eating too much and not moving enough, that's what makes us gain weight. But why? Why do we eat too much? And that's what really interests me. And because of biology, we now know that some people find it more difficult to say no to food. And so, therefore, over 1,000 different feeding decisions, each of which might be binary, if you are a few percentage points more or less likely to say no to the slice of pizza or the chocolate cake, then you're going to be slightly heavier, very heavy, medium size, or skinny in response to the food environment that we live in. So there we go. I'm Giles, geneticist. Obesity is not a choice.
Yeah, my name is Darren Logan. I am my title is the head of research at the Waltham Pet Care Science Institute. I should say right up front, and a conflict of interest statement, that is completely funded and owned by Mars Petcare. So I will do my very best not to be a shill for Mars Petcare today. If you do catch me doing that, do feel free to call me out. But yeah, the work I do now is indeed for a private company, which is one of the largest providers of pet care and pet food in the world. How did I get here? My background also is in genetics, like Giles. Likewise, as to him, I was in Cambridge for 6 years before I moved across the country to Waltham, where we're based. Indeed, I collaborated with Giles a few times because my take, my shtick, if you like, is not dissimilar, though from a slightly different angle to his. So I'm also interested in the genetics of feeding and behaviours that relate to feeding, but from a very different angle. So my interest is in the chemical senses, particularly smell and taste, and how those particular sets of genes, of which there are many, especially in the olfactory system, in mammals, influences our behaviour. And I, for much of my career, I was interested in sort of innate behaviours, so you know, sexual behaviour, aggressive behaviour, and understanding how pheromones interact with them. But I kind of transitioned as I became more aware of actually how just the basic sense of smell and taste that we have has a huge influence on our feeding behaviours. Pets, on the other hand, are a lot easier to manage, right? We give them pretty much all of their food. And if you work for the pet food company that provides the most food to the most pets in the world, and we're talking in the region of 300 million pets every day, there's a huge opportunity there to do science in an environment where you control their entire eating environment. So that was really what tempted me across. My free time when I'm not managing people to try and still stay up to date and publish in the area of smell and taste of cats and dogs.
Thank you so much for putting this on. I can safely tell you, I have never shared a stage with these two gentlemen. Hi, gentlemen. I've never been on the stage with the pet food. I mean, who knew? And Cambridge people. I mean, I don't know if I'm qualified here, but here I am. I'm a senior TED fellow. Who even knows what that means? I don't like titles, and I like that title. And in January, I left academia after a very long time because it bores me, to be honest with you. And I want to do things that matter. I want to take things to people and do things. And yeah, I might get thrown off this Skype, but whatevs. But anyway, I spent a long time in academia and doing all this genetic stuff. I think some people want to call me a computational biologist. Some people want to call me a evolutionary biologist. I'm somewhere in between. I just like really hard problems. And I think that we're in this amazing time where genetics and computing is just transforming lives. And I was asked, you know, probably 6 years or 7 years ago now to work with this group of amazing scientists in East Africa to work on a plant called cassava. And that plant feeds 800 million people. And one of the things that's happening now is there are diseases and pests that are decreasing the yield sometimes to zero. So for us, our project, it's called the Cassava Virus Action Project. Our project has really two focuses. One, smallholder farmers in East Africa shouldn't be hungry. Farmers in general shouldn't be hungry. And two, science just has to be more diverse and inclusive. I mean, we just have to stop having all white dudes run the game. So those are the two things that motivate us to do science. It motivates me to do science. And we saw an opportunity to use portable genomic sequencing. We've been using the Oxford Nanopore technology in combination with other really cool, Microgem has a portable DNA extractor, RNA and DNA extractor. So we've been able to take everything you need from sample to whole genome sequence analysis. We've been able to do that on a farm without power and without the internet while farmers wait. So we've been able to diagnose their plants real time. And that really matters a lot because sometimes the lab to get the samples back to is really far away. And, you know, I don't do this alone. I sit here on behalf of a bunch of really amazing scientists. And we're really just about using technology to make people's lives easier. And in particular, you know, 80% of the farmers are women. And I just care a lot about that.
why cassava? Why so important in that part in Africa?
As the climate is changing, it requires no actual input. It's high calories. The leaves are eaten for protein. And culturally, it's important, right? It's like saying, why rice or why something else, right? It's important. It's an important thing to save. And the farmers have survived on it for a really long time. And actually, you know, it's good for white people too, because the flour is gluten intolerant. So as we progress through this, whatever is happening in this world, climate change, it's going to be an important crop, is my point. But why cassava immediately is it feeds people, and people are starving, and it's ridiculous because we have technology that can help farmers diagnose what's killing their plant and then advise them on varieties that are tolerant to the viruses, right? Because our end game, what we care about, is not impact factors. I don't care at all. That means nothing. Women having more food to feed their family is all I care about. It's all everything that our team cares about. We could care less about these stupid things that academics think matter, because they don't. We care about more food, and that's why cassava.
Do diets work? And if they do, if yes or not, why?
So look, people say that 95% of diets don't work. I think that's the famous saying, right? Yeah, you know, not really technically true. 95% of diets we cannot stick to. So I think any diets, people said, my diet doesn't work. Dude, your diet doesn't work because you're no longer on the diet. So any diet that gets you to eat less is a diet that works. And if you can stick, so that then gets the weight loss. And then if you can stick to the diet long-term, you are then able to keep the weight off. Now, clearly there's stupid diets. A 7-day water fast, of course you're gonna lose weight because you're not eating, but then the weight will come back on. And there are going to be more sensible diets that are actually out there. The critical thing, I guess, diets work, but there is no magic bullet, okay? There is no single universal diet that works for everybody, both from a biological perspective and also from a lifestyle, personal perspective. And so if you need to lose weight, okay, and some people do need to lose weight, then you have to find a diet that suits you, your biology, your lifestyle. Do I work shifts? Do I have kids? Am I rich? Am I poor? Do I cycle to work, et cetera, et cetera? All of those matter, because unless you find a diet that suits both your biology and your lifestyle and your situation in life, you will not be able to stick to it. If you can't stick to it, you'll come off it, and then the weight will come back up. So that's the answer to the question.
Thinking about the obesity in humans, which is massive issue, a health issue throughout the world. What is one of the main health issues in pets, and or one of the health issues that is emerging in pets? Because we have taken them from what used to be a random paleo diet to now they have their specific pelleted diet, and I assume that brings up quite a bit of issues.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's probably not a surprise to you to when I tell you that the same social problems in humans with relation to diet is being replicated increasingly with pets, right? There's a huge obesity problem in both cats and dog populations. And there's an interesting question of why that is, because as I said earlier, we provide the food to our pets, right? It's within our gift, largely, to decide what our pets eat, notwithstanding your cat may go to your neighbor and get a second meal, right? So that's an issue. But we see the same problems emerging. Why is that? Well, they're probably partly because of the same reasons we have the same problem in humans. Our relationship with food is complex, right? We eat not just because we're hungry, we eat because it gives us emotional support, makes us happy. It's a social event, and people treat their pets in the same way. So, you know, cats are notoriously standoffish. So one way to have your pet interact with you, your cat, is to provide it food. Your cat will come to you and you have a moment of joy where you can interact with it. But that comes at a calorific cost, right? You're providing that food to the cat. And quite frankly, if it's not calorifically interesting to the cat, it'll bugger off and go see somebody else. So there's that. You know, people love to see their pet happy. And you know, companies, including my own, are very clever. We know how to market pet food. You can watch TV and you can see those ads about interacting with your pets. And so there is a constant battle of how do you provide food that is nutritious and what we call complete and balanced. So it provides all the nutrients that they need, but not encouraging people to overfeed. So it's a human problem, right? How do we manage humans to provide the right portion size for their pets, just like for themselves and their children?
Darren, if I could jump in there, because there being any studies in which both owner and pet are put on a PET scan, and you correlate the pleasure of, I don't know, like maybe the visual aid of like feeding a pet and the pet actually receiving that food, is there a biological basis or a neural basis for the sense of satisfaction on both sides, the pet and the owner, when you're providing that extra calorie for comfort, I guess?
Yeah, well, I mean, from the pet side, right, I think there's a strong evolutionary pressure towards that, that food was used as part of the domestication process for both cats and dogs. That's how essentially that they became domesticated. And you know, anyone who has a pet will know that food is a hugely useful tool in terms of training a pet, right? I think there's a strong food-driven relationship with both mainly dogs, but cats also, and the relationship with humans. I think there's, in the other side of that is interesting, right? What is the basis of human reward from that? And I'm not aware of any studies that actually directly monitored that. But so there's real complexity. Let me just make one other point on this, though, and I think it's a really interesting one. So Mars is the biggest employer of vets in the world, veterinarians. And we have thousands of veterinary hospitals. And so we're a bigger veterinary business than we are pet food business. And something really interesting came up from my conversations with our veterinarians. And they say there's a real challenge in dealing with pet obesity through the veterinarian, right? And the problem is this. It's really hard for a veterinarian to turn around to an owner and say, your pet is obese, you need to put on a diet, when the owner is obese. So they don't do it. It's a hard conversation to have. And there's a very strong correlation.
I'm Ana Dominguez. I work in Oxford. I have a professorship in Oxford. And I'm currently in Portugal. And I have a question for Giles and another question for Darren regarding animals. And Giles, you equated eating behavior with body weight, or body weight with eating behavior. But what about these people that they can eat anything they want, they can overeat and they always stay thin? And I have an example at home. My husband is like that. So, and there's also animals that I suspect are like that. For instance, greyhounds. Labs, we know that 25% of them, they have that mutation, POMC mutation, and they'll be starving all the time, so they're gonna be the cravers, just like POMC mutants. But there's other dogs that, you know, they'll die before they get fat, and people also. So why is that?
Okay, so I'll go first, Darren. I'll do the, so here, the reason why I equate food intake, feeding behavior and food intake to obesity is because at the moment, that is what the genetics tells us. Now, let's just be clear. Is there a genetics to metabolism, to the energy expenditure? Okay, so in terms of the food intake, the energy expenditure side, undoubtedly, okay? Work by Claude Bouchard many years ago showed that if you actually put twins in an enclosed environment, identical twins, and if you actually feed all the twins, that the twin pairs will gain exactly the same thing. The twin pairs will gain exactly the same amount of weight eating the same thing, whereas different sets of twins will gain different amounts of weight. So undoubtedly, there is genetics underlying it. But yet, when you actually look from a hypothesis-free perspective, when you actually look at the genome-wide association studies that are actually there, we only pick up food intake genes. So, and the question is why? I think there's two answers. There are two, it's not exclusively, but I can think of two reasons. The first is energy expenditure in all its flavors is more difficult to measure than food intake. Food intake in very many ways is something physical. Here is a pizza and I'm eating it. It's weighable, you can see it. It's whereas energy expenditure, largely speaking, is either heat or CO2-O2 mixture. You can do it on an individual basis in calorimeters, undoubtedly, very, very accurately and precisely. But in order to do genetics, you need to be able to do it accurately in a million people. And that is difficult. So that's the first thing. So I think it's a measurement problem. The second is effect size. And so I guess the analogy which I use is a Mars bar. Hello, I'm just talking about Mars bar. A Mars bar is 242 calories, okay, which I know. Don't ask me how I know that. And if I'm motivated, I can finish a Mars bar in less than 90 seconds, less than 60 seconds if I really, really want to. But it will always take me 30 minutes on the treadmill in order to burn it off. We are evolved to eat calories a lot quicker than we burn it, because that's what's kept us alive. And so those are the two reasons why the genetics to date have not yet revealed energy expenditure. First, a measurement problem. Second, effect size. But the genes are there to be found the moment we can measure it better, and the moment we can actually do it in large enough populations. That's my answer to that.
And I would say, I don't know the answer of why specifically greyhounds don't get fat, right? But I agree with you, I've never seen one. And I guess maybe a broader point there is I believe one of the reasons I came to this job is I believe dogs, particularly from a genetic perspective, have a huge potential to shed light on this, right? And that's probably what and they would tell you too, because I believe they're the most morphologically diverse species on Earth, right? And of course that's due to huge selective pressure by us to select for that. So what we've essentially done with the greyhound is through our own nefarious ways selected this highly efficient machine for burning calories, right? And to Giles's point, the genes are there. We've got to find them, and that's a great model for doing
exactly.
So there is people, academic groups, and us at Mars as well. We have a genotyping platform. We've got a quarter million dogs now genotyped, and we have plans of food, as I'm sure Eleanor does, to try and get to the bottom of some of those questions, looking at the genetics.
So Eleanor, just if I can just jump in there, Eleanor mused to me. So this is once again amusing, but it's still an interesting thing. So Labradors, as Anna said, we found that 25-30% of Labradors actually have a mutation in POMC, POMC, a gene which actually makes them more food motivated. Eleanor is in a process of trying to identify why 95% of Labradors are food motivated. Okay, and she's throwing the genetic book at the Labradors. Greyhound. And now Eleanor mused this to me, and I think it's really quite interesting. Whether or not the greyhounds are not lean, but lipodystrophic. So in other words, they have an issue, maybe not entirely, but an issue with actually fat formation. It's just amusing, but it's something to actually think about, because greyhounds are so lean. They are so lean if you look at them. Are they actually lipodystrophic? But that would then ask the question whether or not, and I know nothing, about whether or not there's metabolically, are there issues to show that they could be lipodystrophic? But that's it.
I'm in Eugene, Oregon. I'm a postdoc at the University of Oregon. Disorders of the brain are one of the largest killers of dogs. And so given how significant that is, I'm kind of curious whether, pet food manufacturers are more often now starting to consider the effects on the brain of diet, of diet, nutrition, and the microbiota as well, when they formulate their diets.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, right? So, if I speak to a marketing person, and everybody loves a marketing person, right? They would love nothing more than a little magic bit of fairy dust you add to pet food, and then you solve that problem. Because you're absolutely right. It is the biggest problem in pet care, right? There are huge numbers of dogs, but also cats, end up in homes. Many of them are euthanized, and of course the ideal solution would be exactly that, the magic pill, and of course then you can sell it and make money from it, right? But of course the reality is that many of those dogs don't have a mental illness. Those dogs are bred to act in a certain way by us, and then we don't put them in those environments that they're bred for, right? We put them in a house, don't let them out when they've been bred to go and roam for many miles a day. That's our problem, not their problem. And so the actual solution is much more complicated. It's about educating people to have the right pet for them, and how to look after the pet and train it, and don't get a dog that desires human interaction if you're going to leave it at home all day, et cetera, et cetera. But with all problems, the real solutions are complex, not magic pills. That all said, yes, of course, we would love to find some way of trying to influence the brain through diet. And there possibly is some opportunity in certainly in the anxiety area, right? And is an area where I can say I'm not talking at Mars, because one of our competitors, Nestle, have had a product that they sell for dogs. It's called Fortiflora, I think it's called, but it's a probiotic, a bifidobacterium that they claim calms behavior through the microbiome. It's BL999, catchy name. And you know, I don't know if it works. The data, published data they published is not great, but what data is great in the field of microbiome influencing the brain today, right? So, we've looked at it. I'll be honest with you, it's really hard to do, and it's incredibly difficult to do. And it's even harder to do if you're working in very high ethical standards, because the way that you see a difference in anxiety is you have catcher dogs who are anxious. And if you want to maintain dogs and pets or any animals in a really enriched environment, your opportunity to show an effect gets really small. So we have, despite the pressures of our marketing teams, we have resisted tackling that. Our approach in the microbiome has been, let's understand the fundamentals, right? Let's understand how they work in the gut. Let's understand the bacteria, how they act, and then we'll worry about how they influence the brain. I think trying to run or sprint before we can walk in pets is folly. So, which is not something that we're trying to tackle yet, but obviously we're interested in.
Calling from Japan. It's almost 6:30 in the morning. What my comment and question was, it's kind of related more to the pet food industry, which has nothing to do with what I normally do. I study primates in the wild. I spent 25 years in East Africa as well, Laura, in Tanzania and Kenya, and a little bit in Uganda. I was just curious, there's a growing area of companion animal care using herbal components that are given to the animal as a choice. And they're allowed to select one of these different things, and they can choose as much as they want, so that they're self medicating themselves, basically. They're able to go with their gut feeling. Has the pet food industry been involved or thinking about this area as well? How the food smells, what kinds of things you can put in there that would have not just a nutritional benefit, but also a medicinal benefit that would supplement some of the things that can help pets as well as other types of domestic animals?
Yeah, and I think it's tricky because most pet food providers, the regulatory environment is quite tricky, right? So you've got to walk this very fine line between, are you providing a food or are you providing a medicine? And right. And depending on which side of that line you fall, you run into all sorts of regulatory problems in which agencies you have to work with. So most providers tend to shy away from those things that could be defined as medicines. And so the psychoactive herbs that you mentioned would probably fall within that.
Right. Just to clarify, one thing, when I said psychoactive, I was thinking in a broader sense. I'm not thinking of munchies for pets and things like that. But lavender, mint, things like that can have a very calming effect, and they'll go right straight from the nose to the brain. And
oh, sorry. Yeah. In which case, yeah. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. Then, sorry, I misunderstood you. I thought you meant sort of. And so, yeah. So, sort of.
Darren,
you know where my brain went, right?
Yeah. So,
that's a good point. So, yeah, there is lots of natural botanicals and ingredients are used in pet foods, actually, and both in humans, actually. There's some really interesting data out there to sort of show the calming effect of certain botanicals.
What do you think, and you, I know that each one of you may have a very unique, different perspective from a very different angle. What do you think that in the setting where you are, food will be like in 50 years?
I'll go first. I think a few things. What is food going to be like in 50 years from now? We're going to have to do one of two things. We're going to have to eat less meat. Okay, I think as a population on average, okay, and when I mean less meat, there are some parts of the world that don't have any meat at all or very, very little meat, okay, so almost enforced vegetarianism. And there are other places, such as in Europe, such as in the US, in which we eat way too much meat. And that has a big environmental impact, and that's a huge health impact as well. And so my view is two things. Either we eat less meat, okay, as a whole planet, distribute the amount of meat we eat worldwide. Otherwise, the environment will collapse. So I think that's the first thing. And so I do think that that's going to happen. The second thing is, if we don't eat less meat, and I guess even if we do eat less meat, that a lot of the meat that we actually have might actually be what you or I would not consider it. You know, how many cows in the field, all right? And I just get the feeling that cows in the field will become a luxury at some point, okay? And that a really quite a large percentage of the meat, protein and meat that we actually eat might actually be, in inverted commas, lab grown. So in other words, actually produced, and I use lab grown in its broader sense, it's going to be produced in a way that may be alien to us now, and that the cows in the field are going to be more of a luxury. So that's my view on where I think we're going to be going, that we're going to eat less meat as a species.
I was going to say, I would agree with that. I think just to throw the pet perspective in there, I only found this out actually today when I was doing a little bit of research, because I did do some research, believe it or not, and for this. And is that, did you know that pets eat around a quarter of all the meat in the USA that is consumed or eaten by cats and dogs, right? And so, to John's point, and I completely agree with him, right, that as meat becomes more scarce, or traditional meat, real meat, if you like, becomes more scarce, you know, where's that meat going to come from to feed an obligate carnivore like a cat? We have a fundamental problem. And so, you know, just like in the human space, we got to find additional sources of protein. And it's an additional problem because, unlike humans, you know, cats cannot choose to be vegans. Some people tell you they can. It's technically possible, but, you know, unless you're a pet nutritionist, you'd probably kill your cat within a month, right? So probably not advised. So how do you solve that problem? So I think, again, it's the same issue. On the flip side is, if you took all the meat away that's feeding pets today, the meat industry in the US would collapse. That quarter of the meat that pets eat is not typically the same meats that humans are eating, right? And that supports the human meat industry as well. So the industries for animals and pets and humans are fundamentally linked together in food. So they're going to have to change together, and we're going to have to find solutions that work for both. And I think I'd just make another point to go ahead of that. As part of that solution, I think, will come down to personalization. And I think the anecdote Giles gave you about DNA nudge, which I seem aware of, I know somebody who I won't name, and bought one of those.
Oh,
was very proud of it until he or she told me that it's actually based on 10 SNPs, right?
10?
10. Which, I mean, it's ridiculous enough at the first place. Then you learn it's based on 10 SNPs, and you're like, what a complete and utter waste of time. I think that's the future though, right? And of course, the early innovators are going to be almost laughably bad at it, because, you know, that's always the way. But it is the future, right? And I'm sure with enough data, enough computational power, enough phenotyping, and that's the problem, that's the hard part, right? We will start to understand how individualization through genetics, but also more probably epigenetics and other aspects to biomarkers, will start helping us guide towards not only what food do we like to eat, but also the food that is well suited to us and we tolerate the best.
You guys, food in 50 years, geez, I mean, I am way out of my comfort zone in this conversation, I've got to tell you, because I never think about excess or pets. So my biggest thing is, like, hopefully in 50 years, there'll be, number one, the African continent will be feeding itself and exporting, and that will be a huge source of revenue, right? Like, I just feel like, and then we'll be, the discussion will be more than just, you know, excess and pets for basically European and white people, but there'll be a diverse population having this discussion other than, you know, trying to feed people, but the diversity will be in also pet food and also excess. So in 50 years, Africa will feed itself, the scientists will be in the game, and that's what I hope for, right? I mean, that's what our whole mission is, to work with farmers and work to increase diversity and inclusion in science. And I can only hope that in 50 years, that's true.
There has been a lot of scientific advancements on genetically modified crops, for instance. How do you see deploying those crops in the rural areas?
Yeah.
So, is it acceptable by the farmers? How do they feel about it?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point, because the governments in East Africa haven't made them legal, right? So they sit on the lab fences. So it's not even an option, right? So this is one of the things that we wanted to be in the space of, deploying varieties that were already able to be multiplied and given to farmers, right? Because we can't, at this moment, we can't really wait for these things. I respect the people doing that, and doing that fancy stuff at the Danforth Center and all that. But right now we have solutions that are already conventionally bred that can get to farmers that can tolerate the different pressures in a different situation. But my thought, my feeling on this is I'm given a choice when I go to the grocery store to buy the GMO or the non-GMO thing, right? Why do farmers not get that choice as well, right? These women are smart enough. They're trying to feed their families. Their kids are starving. Mm-hmm. They're hungry, right? And the governments have made a choice that they can't have that choice, right? And so I feel like, you know, hopefully the bills will be passed in the governments, but there's the politics and the corruption and all those things that live around that. And that's, we keep our eye on that. But for us, we wanted to just try to do something now because people need food now, not tomorrow, not in the future, not whatever. Like, you just look in these women's eyes, they need food. They need us to care more than we're doing. And it's like, you know, if you do a sequence, you see the strain it has, you know this variety can give you more yield, deploy that there, right? So I think we're on a short-term and a long-term thing, and I think that the government's going to have to pass bills, and then there's going to have to be a lot of outreach to inform farmers that the crops that they're going to grow are safe and they should be given a choice.
I love that for two reasons. There are, from my personal perspective, there are at least two layers in that answer. One is... thank you so much for making us aware of a different dimension that normally we are not exposed to. And second, this tagline, the politics of science is as important as the science that we do. Going to school in Honduras, I went to an agricultural school in Honduras, and that was in my first week in training. It was my first exposure to GMOs. And we were sent onto the field to harvest corn from GMOs. I was explained for 30 seconds what a GMO was, and I remember that the biggest thing that everybody had, it was like, "Ooh, should I touch this thing because I'm gonna be glowing after I leave the field?" And that was from students already. Like, imagine from people in the field that were applying it. It was exactly what Laura said. Like, it was this: how do you bridge the cultural aspects, the situational and the contextual aspects of the people, so you can deploy some of these technologies to make a difference?
So yeah, I'm joining you guys from Doha, Qatar, Middle East. It's 15 past midnight, so I should be asleep right now. You know, as we move on to this age of genomics and personalized everything, right? There's a lot of talk around personalized nutrition and 3D printed food. What are your thoughts on 3D printed food, and how do you conciliate these with the potential budding field of personalized nutrition?
Who wants to go first on that one?
Anyways, I'm just hearing about 3D printed food right now, so I am like legit not it on this one.
So, okay, I'll answer the question, not necessarily on 3D printed food, but I think on non-traditional foods just in general. I think we talked about someone asked a question, we were discussing the GMO foods. Here's the issue. I think there is a lot of fear, I guess understandably, because it's food that we actually put in our mouth, about what we do to food. Okay, now some of it is completely unfounded, but nonetheless understandable fear. There's also a lot of pseudoscience and a lot of fear-mongering that is actually out there about food. And so I think we need to unpick, first of all, the science behind the food, behind GMO food, what is organic, what we are supposed to be eating, what are we supposed to be growing, who's eating what. You know, is meat good or bad for you? All that kind of thing. And I just get the feeling that once we get into a mature discussion about what we can do with our food, that just calling something natural or real or clean makes it better than something else. I think once we get past that discussion and can have a non-hysterical discussion about food, then I think the 3D printed space will actually come into its own. Because I think there are going to be a significant number. We're going to be protests. You say that we're going to have 3D printed food right now. There's going to be the same people who protest against anti-vaxxers are going to come out and protest as well. So I think there is a broader issue. I have never heard of 3D printed food, by the way. I've heard of lab-grown meat, but I presume that the same issues are going to be there until we tackle the pseudoscience around the fear of food and these the adjectives which you use, real, false, clean. And once we get past that, then I think we can talk about rolling out something like 3D printed food. Anyway, that was just an opinion.
Giles's media training came to the fore there. Don't answer the question that was asked, just answer the point that you want to make, right?
So thank you, Darren.
I will say something about 3D printed food. So everyone can turn off at this point because I'm going to talk about extrusion, which is the most dull thing ever, unless you understand it. And extrusion is a process, right, that you make a certain type of food. So we make pet food, dry pet food through extrusion. Pasta is made through extrusion. So it's forcing mushed material through a screw, as it's called, and it comes out as a shaped, as a sort of a softer thing, and it hardens, and you have a shaped material. So that's how you get like pasta, right? And what I've learned from extrusion in the pet food world is that you can do amazing things with food, and maybe to where you're coming, Louise, with this, there is some really cool stuff you can do with extrusion, and then presumably on top of that, 3D printing on top of that, allows you to have really, really interesting opportunities. So someone asked a question on here about, can you make non-calorific pet treats? And the answer is probably no, but you can get close. And the way you can do that is by you aerate food, right? So you can fill it with air, and it's bigger. And so people feel like they're eating more and they get fuller, but they're just eating air. And it works really well for pets, actually. So the way that you have these sort of satiety diets for cats and dogs is you basically aerate the food and you trick them into thinking they're eating more calories than they are. The humans think you're giving your pets more. Look, this big bowl of food that I've given my dog, it's all air. And of course, the added bonus of that is that you're selling people air, right? And you're giving a premium cost on it. So it's a win, win, win.
I just am hearing about 3D food. Luis, what in the actual hell is that? I don't even want to know. I really don't want to know. I'm going to Google it later. But one thing I've learned about working with farmers is you can 3D print all you want until the cows come home. And if they don't want to eat it or grow it, it's all that matters, right? So I think in all of these discussions about everything we do also is like, you can do something to a plant, but the only thing that truly matters is this is a farmer preferred variety, right? So as you're 3D printing your food, make sure the end game is somebody's actually going to buy it and it matters. Like, because there are so many examples of scientists sitting so far away from the actual people they're serving that they generate these varieties of plants or animals or something, and farmers don't like it. And the only way you can check that out is to ground truth what you're doing, right? Because we go out and we supply material for farmers that's virus resistant. But in the back of the farm, you wander around and guess what? The local variety is back there because that's the one that you have to have at Easter or you have to have whatever. So all of these things need to be encompassed with the cultural parts that really matter if you're going to have big uptake of something. And that's my two cents.
I'm Laura. I'm at home in Cary, North Carolina. I'm a postdoc with Diego. It seems that, you know, although you're at different spectrums of the problem, maybe the science of excess, Laura, as you said, for Giles and Darren. Darren, maybe you disagree, but it seems like pet food could be considered excess as we think about, you know, the environmental impact of food and obesity. And then the opposite problem, people not having enough access to food. And I was wondering if there are, it seems like there's a lot of similarities to not the problem, but perhaps the approach. And I was wondering if there are any initiatives or any data to speak to how those communities can come together to inform each other as we move forward, you know, 50, 100 years from now in the future of food.
Okay. I'm going to give the, Darren's going to call me a politician for answering this question. I think when I mean excess, and I think it's an interesting thing when we talk about excess, because I think the type of excess we're talking about is not the good type of excess. And it's interesting, the UNICEF childhood malnutrition report from the end of 2019 asked a question. This is childhood malnutrition. Why are so many children not getting enough of what they need? And so many more others, there are now more children in the world, getting too much of what they don't need. You know, and both sides of the malnutrition question. And so I think I would like to think from my perspective of excess that A, we want to try and fix the excess from a bad perspective, but yet get that access to people who actually need the food. So I think excess comes in a whole bunch of different flavors. And certainly in the West, it's got this real oddity of all these calories that are there, but yet people are getting so much of what they don't actually need. and are being malnourished from excess calories, which is what a weird world to be living in. So I would hope, you know, looking forward in the 50 years, that we will somehow square this problem and try and sort ourselves out.
Maybe I'll jump in, because I think I fully suspect Laura has probably got the killer argument for this. I'm going to get in there before that so she can wrap up with the killer argument. I guess I'm going to step away from my scientific expertise and then give you another perspective. So, as you know, because I said it multiple times, I left academia and I knew nothing about business and joined Mars. And while I joined Mars Petcare, Mars, as you all know, also makes candy and gum and a lot of food, right? Uncle Ben's, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a massive organization, multinational, that moves huge amounts of raw materials around the world, right? And particularly in Africa and South America, they are heavily involved in cocoa production, right? Making chocolate, obviously. And what opened my eyes is just the complexity of global supply chains, right? And actually why Mars is so successful is what they're really good at is moving shit around, right? They can move stuff around at scale, and it's really impressive. But it's really complicated, and you get all these weird things that happen, right? That whereby exactly, and we've seen it actually come to light in this COVID situation. You've probably all seen the same headlines, right? One headline, farmers are having to burn potatoes because they can't move them. And on the other hand, there's not enough food for food banks, right? How can that possibly be in the same country, in the same state, even, probably in the same city, right? It's insane. How can this be? But it's all because of supply chains. And so I think maybe something that makes good that can come up to this situation in this globalized world we live in, where we're moving food around the world, is to rethink that a little bit, right? And so maybe, you know, an element of hope in these challenging times is that this may cause us to think a little around how that works. But I think the other thing is that the two are fundamentally related at source, and this is probably where Laura can comment much more than I, which is taking our example, right? The fact that we are producing cocoa to feed the global habit for chocolate, which is mainly a food for the West and developed world, right? Because chocolate melts in Africa and Asia, right? So, and it's not made for those people, right? It's made for the taste of the rich white folks in the West. And because we have such intense financial pressure to generate those crops, that is the reason that other crops are not being made for local people in those environments to eat, right? So the actually does come down to the source, I think, right? That's the change that we have to make to solve this problem. And with that, I'll probably hand over to Laura, who could talk about that much more eloquently than I can.
Oh my gosh, that's pressure, Darren.
That's what I did.
Gosh, like seriously. Okay, so I think that one of the things, I mean, this is only like my second Zoom call of this whole ordeal because I was sort of trapped in Uganda and had to be evacuated and it was a little traumatic and I was food scarce. I mean, Giles, I got back here and I ate pizza. So I'm not going to lie about
it. I'm not judging. I just
ate some pizza last night. So I was like, he's talking about pizza and oh my gosh. Anyway, so I think that for me, one of the reasons why I agreed to do this is number one, Diego is a TED fellow. And number two, I really am outside of my comfort zone. And you guys that are all interested in the gut-brain interaction, you're all at this amazing forefront of science of uncovering that, and also Mars is sequencing 100 orphan genomes in Africa. So I was like, oh, okay, these will be cool people. So they're not going to throw me off or disconnect me for caring about diversity and inclusion in science. But I feel like we're at this moment where you guys are in this really cool space of doing this really intricate work, and you have a chance to actually make a difference by including other people in this, you know, like really making, because you think, what can I do? How can I bridge the pet food to the farmers? And it all hangs around science, doesn't it? Because we're all using technology, genomics, and that means that when we invite people to conferences, we really think about how we're going to make this the best event it can be with the diverse group of people. And you know, we just need to all band together. And then the bridge between having too much and studying pet food and farmers not having enough, scientists can make that happen. Scientists are the ones that people trust us, they care about us, and we can do it in our own way. I think that just rallying around a technology, and in spaces that are at the forefront, it's where you can actually, you have enough leeway to be inclusive about the way you're doing science. And so that's why I agreed to do this, because, and I'm also fascinated about the topic, because I just, it seems like such a luxury to study what's happening in the gut when it's empty, you know? So I feel like in the future, it's going to be amazing to study that. And I want the people that have had a really different environmental aspect to their upbringing, right, to be able to be in that discussion. So that is why I'm here, and that is why I care, and that is why I Google stalk Giles and Darren and all you people that studied this stuff. But I didn't get 3D printed food in my Google stalk. So anyway, that's why I'm here, and I just hope that I can, if there's anything that you guys think I can be of help with or connecting with or whatever, we're here in the game.
And that was a phenomenal message to wrap up this conversation.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. For more of our content, you can follow us on Twitter at GutBrains or visit our website at thinkgastronauts.com. The Gastronauts podcast would be impossible without our incredible team. Meredith Schmel is our producer and theme music composer. And special thanks to the founders of Gastronauts, Dr. Diego Borquez and the Borquez Laboratory.